We're going to make this a little informal, and it's a small enough group that I want this to be very interactive. I don't want it to be just the panelists talking. I want to hear what you all think, too. We may pull some of you up here and swap out panelists as I've seen that done before pretty effectively, because I think there's a lot of people here with a lot of different backgrounds. And like I said before, I mean, release engineering really is a relatively new field. And so I'm really curious to know what people think about where it's going based on what your experiences are. I had an interesting conversation with our board member rep in the back there, in the green shirt, David Wave. He's been the person that's been shepherding me through this process and helping make this conference a success. And, you know, we believe that there's a lot of overlap between release engineering and system administration and what's happening with LISA, and that we're going to see more and more of LISA kind of offer tutorials and talks for release engineers. And so, you know, that's kind of our prediction, I guess, on what's going to happen. And so I'll let Sarah introduce herself, because she hasn't spoken before in front of us. And so basically the first question is, you know, what are your predictions about what's going to happen in release engineering over the next 5 years in terms of anything from job descriptions to technology to whatever?
Okay. So in a way, hi, I'm Sarah Elkins. I talked at the Config Management Summit yesterday. What I see is kind of, in some ways, a circling back around to how it was more when I was starting to do SCM 20-something years ago, where there was a lot of software config management, where there was also a lot of release management, not release engineering, but we had, you know, I was doing delivering code that would be embedded on printers that Xerox put out there, and, you know, had to be, someone had to go and fix the copier in the church basement or whatever, you know, which sort of is like the mobile problem, only not, because obviously over the air updates are easier than getting into the nuclear facility to fix their printer. But the release management aspect of, you know, well, we have all these different code lines with different people out there that are running code that won't let go of their old code. You can hear, you know, some of those problems are coming back again, whereas there had been a simple, smooth, you know, web sort of approach. And I just kind of see, you know, what's old is new again, but of course there are differences. I do think that that kind of people interaction is going to be more and more important for, I mean, not people, but coordination aspects as well as the tech part is going to have to be a more important part of release engineering than it has been, because of, it's not just the technical question, it's the question of how do you manage all these different releases that are out there that need to be out there that are not maybe going to go back to one main line again. So that's an answer for now anyway.
Okay, and well, my name is John Odin. I was here this morning. I recognize at least many of the faces. I think, yeah, there's an aspect of the job is it's the technical problems, both in terms of machinery and figuring out what to do, and also the human coordination and communication part. I think that mix and the, you know, the ability I talked about earlier about the ability to have those two mixes and also stay, be very calm when everyone else is getting upset is this kind of like why this becomes a self-selecting audience, I think. I think that's going to be more kind of publicized, or more, the awareness on that's going to go up a little bit. I think the reason it's becoming more noticed now is we used to, like when I first started writing code, pretty much everything was closed source, and, like, you know, same here. So it's now larger and larger, more organized open source projects have clearly visible open roles that do how stuff gets done. You can see where the branches are, where there are, and you could have like religious wars about whether you should do branching this way or that way, should you name it this way or that way. But the fact that there is somebody whose role is to kind of be the coordinator, and there's some role around setting up the plumbing to make the coordinator's job even possible, those are now clearly noticed in large open source projects. Apache, Mozilla ones mm-hmm. are the ones that come to my mind, but there's others. And I think that's something that's a big change, and that's why it's becoming more visible in the industry. Now you're seeing people looking, they're doing a closed source project in some company doing whatever, but look at, they see what happens in the open source world. So that I actually see as a big pivotal turning point for this business. I know that's my 2 cents.
Just to follow up on what John said there, kind of associated with this, what I see for the future, I hope, are stronger release engineering teams within the organization. So again, having done this off and on as a developer and as a release engineer for like 25 years, in the old days, I mean, I'll just get an anecdote. My wife, I would come home at night, like even in these days, I say, oh, Sylvia, you know, I got like 5 recruiters contact me today. They want me to work, you know, some crazy company. And she told me, yeah, I told you, no one wants to do what you do, right? So it's, yeah, of course, you know, who's going to do that? But obviously, we all know the value, and our companies hopefully all know the value because we're sitting here at least. And I think I've worked hard, at least at Facebook, both organically and by my own determination, made release engineering a central part of the culture at Facebook. And I think we did as well as one of the first release engineers at Google that also set a very strong kind of precedent for like, listen, this is a core thing that you're going to pay attention to. And it in Facebook, it went all the way up to, you know, management team support. So I know for a fact, my VP of engineering, I know Mark Zuckerberg, I know my VP of infrastructure all support me when it comes to like, okay, you know, your changes can't come out. I mean, this is, we can't do this. We can't ship this. This doesn't make sense. You know, this is going to be a problem. And I'm probably maybe the extreme example because I've been there long enough where I can embed myself and get away with the nonsense I get away with. But just from looking at the recruiting mail and the kind of the way I'm approached and I think the way we're all approached now, it seems like the respect level has definitely gone up since the old days of release engineering, and we need to do more to kind of assert ourselves within our organizations safely. I don't want to get anyone, you know, shit-canned for mouthing off to the CTO like, this is crap and you're full of baloney. So, you know, basically use your judgment within your organization, but find someone in the management chain while looking up that will help support you and kind of, you know, growing the team and making the team good decision makers and strong strong force for good in the company. Of course, with the great power comes great responsibility, so you want to basically make sure you're not obstructionists or seen as people slowing down the process or just being a big pain in the neck and a bunch of people who are just, you know, hand-wringing, complaining about things not going well. But make sure you're enabling the company, making good things happen, and go ahead and take some of that control.
Okay, so anybody in the audience care to answer that question or pose their own question to the panel? Yeah, I'm going to make you use the mic.
So I haven't been doing this for very long, but all I have to say is that what I see is that I see it used to be one person, and now you're saying the word team, and that's the one thing. I think we're getting a lot more recognition that it's not just one job. Right. It's lots of different things.
Hi, my name is David on behalf of Usenix. So my question is, especially the folks who have been doing it forever, like Chuck, what are some of the still unsolved problems in release engineering?
Let John go, you know, everyone can go on this one, but for me, obviously the one is mobile. Mobile is, you know, it's funny because it has been solved. We've solved the basic problems of how to ship software 4 times in, you know, my lifetime. First things we used to ship, operating systems, right? That's the first thing I shipped for IBM. I worked for IBM, AWD, and IBM Research. So we shipped operating systems, and that was a specific way you shipped operating systems. We invented the tools and the process and the way to get it out. And then it was ship software and enterprise software, and then it was, you know, web and web 2.0 and that. Now it's mobile, so we're going to, you know, invent it again. So for me, that's all my effort is going into mobile, and that's all I care about right now. There's probably more interesting things besides mobile, but if anyone has examples of what they're working on or what the big thing for them is.
So one of the problems I'm very aware of is more an organizational issue that I don't see an easy solution for outfits that are comprised of different bodies with different interests. For instance, I do federal contracting, where the IT support organization is a completely different contract and body of employees than the people doing development for one project or the people doing development for another, and you've got contractual issues going on there. That kind of places where there is some siloization by the nature of, you know, the mandate of how federal agencies have to use contractors for, you know, some of their work. I'm not sure out organizationally we can take a look at some of the best of release engineering and draw what we can from it, but I'm not sure how we go to a solid DevOps sort of, you know, there's only us, not us and them. In attitude, we can as much as possible, but there are structural setups that, you know, I don't think the entire field can move over to, you know, one unified DevOps or whatever, as long as there are some enterprises and some organizations that have kind of structurally enforced tendencies towards siloization.
So people is what you're saying. There's still an unsolved problem.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, what's that called, wetware? I'm not sure. I have a slightly yes, plus one to each of these. I would actually add another one, which is I stumbled into doing release engineering. Right? You know, I have an associate's degree and a master's in computer science. And I never once heard the word release engineering anywhere through any of that. And in my career so far, everyone else I've met has said the same to me when I say that. Like
anybody here woke up one morning and said, "I want to be a release engineer."
Right, like most people run screaming. If you know, they're like, "Oh no, how did I get to be the build guy in the corner?" Right, you know, it's kind of. So that's one perception, but there's actually not even an understanding in the general developer community. I meet some guys who've just come out of college. They're convinced that they know everything because they're now 24 and they've just got their degree and they're going to solve world peace in the next 90 days. And I'm like, "Good for you," but they've never heard of like doing a branch. And they stop and try and read it on GitHub, and they're like, "What's this?" You know. So I think if I had a magic wand, I'd say as part of every computer science university course, there must be some X amount of time, and I'm not a lecturer, so someone else do this better. But some X amount of time that says, you know, you do your assignment, and when you're finished with your assignment, you have to commit it into a source code repo, and then the next assignment, which builds on it, you pick someone else's, and you pull it from the source repo and commit, and you know, teach people about branching and code maintenance and those kind of longevity of source code. It's not dispose and throw away stuff. I think that would help on the general awareness of the overall. Like I spend a lot of my time talking to developers explaining why branching or revisions matter because they've never heard of it.
If it's any comfort, if I take my Usenix hat off and put on my day job hat, I'm at Northeastern University's College of Computer Science, and they do in fact have classes that do precisely that, where people have to swap code bases, and they all have to get it out of, you know, it's all committed and all sorts of good stuff like that. So that's being done, but so that might lead to another question, if there aren't others, which is, if you were to design a boot camp for release engineers, what would you force them to go through?
I'm not organizing it, but I've just had a flash in my head. There's a university in Montreal. The people who helped organize the conference in April.
Graham and those guys?
Yes, Graham and those guys. They're actually running some release engineering summer camp time thing as part of the Polytechnic in Montreal. And I'm afraid you'd have to look it up on Google to get the details. But sorry,
that's even better a segue.
Yeah.
Which is if the three were to sit down and design a boot camp, where you pick your favorite person who has a degree in anything, linguistics or computer science or anything like that, and say, okay, here's what you need to know to become a release engineer. I heard the calm and peacefulness, and perhaps, you know, a little bit of meditation wouldn't be a bad part of it. But what are the things would you put into that week, let's say, if you had a week or 2 weeks to boot camp somebody into being a release engineer?
I would like to go first on this one, then I'll hand the mic over. I think like some rudimentary, like, yes, sure, everyone thinks Git is the most fashionable thing today, so that's great. I think, but you should learn like at least three revision control systems, right? Like CVS or SVN, ClearCase and Git or Mercurial. I mean, something that shows different mindsets in the technology over the decades, right? That'd be one thing. And I would try and make sure people have learned the headaches of code cherry picking and, hey, it worked here, but when I cherry picked 3 out of 5 changes over here, it didn't work. I wonder what happened. So that kind of thing. I think there's a separate thing, which is I think people should actually take classes in, like conflict negotiation, like, never mind the technology, like, where are you guys going for lunch? What do you mean you want to go there? I'm not doing that. You know, like, get people to work through how to have a discussion where it's not about agreement equals the other person gave up and walked away, but it's agreement where you all came to an agreement. And that's something that's not in most computer science courses.
No, absolutely.
And I think that's probably what I spend at least 60% of my day doing.
Awesome.
So I think that's a technical and a human thing.
Oh, can I go? Opinion. I have an opinion on everything. So there's two approaches to this. There's the kind of the top down and the bottom building blocks. And the building blocks I think of are source code management, knowing how to do build configuration files properly, understand how to do packaging properly. And so all of those are skills you need, but you also need to understand, I guess, some of the soft skills like the conflict management. Process, understanding about process. What does it mean to do end-to-end deployment? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to do a pipeline? And so you really, to be a release engineer, you need a mix of all these different skills. And how do you turn that into a curriculum is not an easy thing to do, I don't think. But it would be fun to try.
Yeah. I think it would be a great boost to business, actually. But
one thing my college did when I actually went there, 84 to 88, was in the computer science program, they had team classes where you had to be on a software team of 4 people or whatever, and it was whole group, pass or fail. I think that's one thing that's useful for people who've only been working on their own thing, you know, even if they've been submitting things elsewhere and hoping it gets pulled into the main repository. I think having to sit there and work with people, hashing something out, maybe in conjunction with conflict resolution teaching. But then the other thing is, for someone to know whether they're going to be able to cope with being a release engineer, I think it's very useful to make someone have to debug code they've never seen before. Not necessarily the code, but a build break where it's not well documented. I mean, that's part of our job. And, you know, you have to know, do you have the temperament to do that kind of thing or not? And I think, you know, it's the kind of thing, until you've really sat there and tried to wrestle with something that, you know, either it works on my machine or whatever the issue is, it's hard to know. You know, you can kind of imagine, well, it's not going to be like that. I'll be at Facebook, or, you know, I'll be somewhere where all the engineers are top of the line and nobody ever makes mistakes. Yeah, I mean, people, I think it's important to give people a sense of realism to know whether they're going to be able to sustain, because that's a lot of the job. Dealing with conflict is a lot of the job, and you have to be able to do that if you want to do release engineering, or you'll stop doing release engineering.
Cool. To say, we have it's actually pretty good shape right now. So if I had to start a boot camp or a class, we actually have some good text now. We've iterated in the last 10 years especially into a lot of good practices. So we have, like, you know, Jess Humble's book, and John Ospaul has a bunch of stuff published. So you have a body of work that we could actually go from, and you could almost do a class, a full semester class, on their techniques and all the DevOps crap that we've kind of learned and assimilated, and the stuff related to it about monitoring, and throw in some SRE and some of that stuff on the edge, and you got a pretty nice, complete package that you could totally give to a university as a part of a track. And I spent a lot of time recruiting, and I've been to universities, And I mean, some universities are more hands-on than others. And I went to RIT in Rochester, New York, where I graduated, and I went up there. And they have a track that is like sysadmin kind of track. And in there, you mix in some SRE stuff, some release engineering stuff. So I had a good conversation with a professor up there who is actually introducing some new DevOps requirements into his group projects, like you say. And so there's glimmers of hope. There are certain schools, and you mentioned Northeastern's a good one, Waterloo, Cal Poly. There's that, yeah, we should remember that school in Montreal that's doing all the, they're actually doing some research, kind of researchy papers on code velocity versus commit or versus ship date and other little analyses of the code development process. So there's promising glimmers. I think we're in the best time for having new people come out of school and be competent in this field. So we should all kind of encourage that, and we have to, you know, give back to these schools and kind of help them develop these programs as well.
Thanks, everybody, including Madam Moderator.
Sure.
Any other questions, comments? Anybody want to answer the question? Go ahead, go for it.
I've got a question that might be a little bit more of a software engineering question than a release engineering question, but one of the nice things about tests for maintaining quality is that for the most part, they're sort of binary. They either pass or fail, so you can hold up a merge based on them. But some of the things like static analysis sometimes aren't, or a lint tool that might give you some warnings. What we've done so far is we've sort of figured out how to turn those into binary things where we ignore some set of warnings and it turns into pass or fail, but I'm not really satisfied with that. Do you guys have any thoughts on how to take advantage of these tools that are don't just pass or fail and figure out how to use them for integrating code?
I don't actually have an answer to that yet, but while everyone else is thinking, I will say the bit about tests that pass or fail, I've found to be true for the first 100 or two. Once you start getting into tens of thousands, then you always have some small percentage that are just intermittent orange failures or intermittent reds, and you rerun them and they work. So, for example, what Chuck was doing in terms of the test karma, or you know, ranking for tests kind of thing, I think it's really great, especially if you can find a way to automatically do it. So that tests that humans over time say, oh, you know, test 24 is always fails out, I'll just run it again, it'll pass. At some point, that should become a pulled out test that actually might be a test problem, a test framework problem, or actually a test correctly uncovering a real intermittent product problem. And you don't know, right? So. I think intermittent results is something we have a big problem with, tests and also other tools.
I agree there can be value in flaky results if you have the capacity to dig down and look at them. Sometimes you'll never figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. And I do think there needs to be a better way to separate those out, maybe prune them entirely, or maybe just get them out of the automated tests so that they're more for the testing group that might do, if there is a testing group, whoever might be doing some exploratory or discovery sort of analysis of how the software is doing rather than things that can be automated. I do think we could do more programmatically to recognize those. Pattern recognition, you know, set up neural network analysis of all these tests. This kind of test failure never gets fixed in code. Take that out, and do something else with it, either throw it away or give it to somebody who likes grappling with that kind of thing, but not have it in the, everybody sees this and it slows down the release output. I think there are ways to deal with that programmatically. It's just something that hasn't been dealt with much yet.
How many people have trouble with flaky tests and arguing with developers about flaky tests? It's a big problem.
So yeah, we use, you know, the Karma system's great because I'm trying to think of automated things, and there's various things you can come up with, and Karma's one. The other is, we'll go on the other side, and there is a big cultural thing. One is, you know, we, Facebook and Google as well, have a test-driven development culture. So in fact, the tool itself, like Fabricator, when you submit a diff, will actually get pissed off if you don't have a test it knows if you've done a test with the diff, or if it's a new file or something, and it says like, hey, I don't see a test for this. And it's going to flag that. And it's up to you to culturally to implement that as a blocker or a warning. And this is when it comes down to the whole thing. Our static and lint analysis is actionable. If there is a red one there, it needs to be looked at. Mm-hmm. And this is a culture thing that right now you're a small company and you're like, let's get shit done. And we can you can probably abide by a little bit more slop in the what's red or orange and, or not when it comes to static analysis and lint and all that. But when you're a big enough company and there's 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 developers, in our case, committing code to something that's kind of mission critical, you make the decision culturally where it's like, yeah, we just hold the line, you know? And if that lint rule is stupid, then get rid of it. But if it's red, it's got to be looked at. And to make that work, you need some crazy asshole advocate who every company's got one, right? Who kind of really is the keeper of the culture of like, this is the way our code looks. This is the way our lint rules pass. This is our you know, yeah, we don't do that here. You know, you can't get around like that. And I, you know, it's a little dangerous because that person can be overbearing or a jerk, but not always. Because in the end, if as long as what they're thinking is for the best interest of the company, not just to impose their rule, but to be an advocate for like this culture that served us well and got us to where we are, and we don't want to go back to how it was because it was crappy. You know, the person who can span the gap of crappy times to good times and can point like, well, this is why it's no longer crappy times, and help enforce that culture that got you there. That helped a lot.
Yeah, if I can piggyback on that communication part of this, like, why are we doing static analysis? Why are you doing lint? Like, it's not just another thing to try and trip you up to stop you landing your code, right? So one company I worked at, which was not an open source company and shall remain nameless, an analysis of all these intermittent, you know, here's all this, all the intermittent failures we're dealing with. Like, we had X number of failures with this release, and X number of failures with this release, et cetera. And just going back in time as a big trawl through giant log files exercise. And they matched it up to when they started linting and fixing things like buffer overruns. And, you know, like, nothing rocket science here, just like housekeeping. The amount of those intermittent failures plummeted, and the amount of field reports coming in from production outages plummeted. And that's when, again, communication, that's when VP started going, whoa, every one of those production outages cost us X amount per second, and suddenly there was a value attached to making sure lint stayed green. And that education took a while. It actually took a lot of upfront work to make people even understand it. Right? I think that's one thing that we as an as a group of people need to do, and like we were talking about communication earlier, some of it's conflict communication, some of it's just even explaining why stuff matters in the language of the listener. And so, that's an example.
So I wanted to follow up more specifically on the warnings part of your question, because we got more onto like build breaks and intermittent tests. So I do think that paying more attention to warnings, I mean, yes, there can also be stabilization effects from doing that, but developers do get, you know, and we get trained to ignore warnings during builds because most of them, it looks like things still work okay if you push out the code that had warnings. But I was just reading yesterday, I think maybe from someone retweeting something at one of the other tracks today or yesterday, I was reading about compilers that drop unstable code. And you get warnings during the compilation process mixed in with the other 300-something warnings for the compilation. And in some cases, the compiler is right to drop it, and in some case, there's a very rare condition that, you know, the compiler somehow thinks no one really needs to do this buffer check of this incredibly huge number. So it's out. You know, I don't know enough about the compilation why it would do that, but I was reading that there are compilers, and this is a known issue among people who do compiler stuff, but it was kind of news to me. I do think, you know, warnings are important. Some warnings are important, you know, I mean, and it's great if you can get to where your code has absolutely no warnings, but otherwise, you've got the issue of kind of noise mixed in with warnings that might actually matter a lot. And I think that, You know, again, some of that can be programmatic to just scan the output of the builds and look for maybe some keywords along the warning strings, but it's also partly going to be experience. So anyway.
Thanks.
So I'm not a release engineer. I apologize. I actually chaired the Configuration Management Summit yesterday. And we all came into the room, and it was a room full of 30 people, and we all had our hands in the air running around, bumping into each other, going, oh my God, Docker. The systems that we are configuring are going to completely change. How do we do this? How do we, you know, what do we do? How do we do it? And I expected to come in here today and see the same thing, a room full of 30 people running around with their hands in the air, bumping into each other, going, oh my God, the artifacts we ship are going to completely change. What do we do? How do we do it? And instead, you know, Glenn stood up and said, here's the tool that's going to completely change your job in the next 3 to 5 years, at least if you're shipping 12-factor apps, and everyone was just totally zen about it. How and why and how can I get some of that?
More coffee.
So we've heard this story before.
Yeah, actually.
And you know, and Docker's awesome. I'm all for it. But you know what? Facebook invented our version of Docker called Tupperware, and Google invented their version of npm and Borg and other things. And yeah, we've all been through this. And also, you know, for me, you're talking about 1/5 of my life cycle. Like, it's actually the uninteresting part when I have the artifact. You know, once I have the artifact, I wanted to get it into a package and out to the door. It's like, okay, it's nice that that's handled, but I've been writing scripts to just do that, you know, by myself for years, and it's, you know, there's ways to do with it, and we've had plenty of tools around. So yeah, I'm excited for Docker. I'd like to see it be successful. I want Google to do all the hard work. I'm making it bulletproof and enterprise ready, so I can use it when they're done. It's not the whole, you know, we have a lot of stuff before we hit Docker that we got to worry about. So that's why I wasn't jumping up and down too much.
So in my group, we have a saying, there's no shortage of work. And I don't see Docker changing that. It may slightly change the nature of our work, but it just keeps coming and coming. And you know, that's not to say that the picture won't be different 15 or 20 years from now, but man, there's still sure a lot to be done. And so I guess, you know, I do kind of see, like, you know, changes keep coming and we keep rolling with them, and it'll be great if some of these new techs solve some of our problems, but I just don't see, you know, all our problems going away and we'll all then start looking for other jobs. You know, I think we've got a long, you know, list of things to work on, and I think that as people realize more and more the value that release engineering can add to a company, I think that that'll kind of keep expanding. Like we were saying about, you know, looking more at warnings analysis, or, you know, there's other areas to go for where we can really, I think the scope will keep expanding of things that seem relevant to release engineering.
I think there's two parts to it. Apart from the technology side, like, there's new technologies, never mind the actual pluses and minuses or whatever, Docker. There's new technologies coming along all the time, and I think maybe I'm channeling other people in the room here, but I think everyone here has gone through at least 4 or 5 title shifts in the industry. And so it's like, okay, it's a title shift, you know, it's like, it happens, you know. But like, okay, you know, I think the other part of it is, and I wasn't in the track yesterday, so I don't know the personalities of the people in the room who are doing this, but I think you are looking at, I think the sign of what it makes release engineers, they don't panic, right? That's actually an important characteristic. If anyone survived as a release engineer for more than a couple of years, you've self-selected, you know, you actually have not blown a gasket somewhere in there. And so I think you could, I mean, whether you want to talk about like how you have to manually click through things when you're trying to upload a multilingual mobile product, or whether you, these are all, they've changed the user interface. Now you have to put in localized legal text and you discover this on release day, right? They frustrate us, but they're not in any way like stressful in the kind of hands in the air running around. So I think it's a testament to the type of people that do release engineering, actually.
We found that system administrators make great release engineers because they have many of the characteristics we want. They usually, most of them, if they work for a software company, they've dealt with source code repository, probably managed and set it up. They're used to dealing with people in a crisis situation. They know how to handle the stress. They're used to dealing with deployment. And so a lot of times you can't, it's hard to go out and find a release engineer. And so sometimes you look for people with the skills you need. And so system administrators looking for a different career path make great release engineers.
So we're all not calm and collected. I've had a couple blowouts over the years. Not me personally. I don't think I have. No.
I mean, I definitely got upset. Don't get me wrong. I'm not Mr. Zen, not 365, but, you know.
No, I had a heart arrhythmia for 3 weeks that I had to go to the hospital for and wear a monitor. So I had this holster device for a week because I didn't have a normal heartbeat for literally a week straight. Just not
never,
a normal.
Never done that. No.
And I'm like, okay. And the doctor's like, well, you're under stress? I'm like, yeah, I'm under stress. And the joke was we were going to hook up the heart monitor to one of our graphs so we could see how the push was going. But I could step back and say, all right, relax. And that went away, so I'm fine. But I had one release engineer quit on me, just rage quit, while I was on vacation. He stayed till I got back. I sent him back to Google. And I had one. I had one release engineer, a new guy, who worked. He's good, but he hasn't gotten it yet. And you know, he once punched $1,000 Dell 30-inch monitor across the room. Just off it went. Which was disruptive and probably not healthy for us. So it is, you know, and these are junior, you know, this is a more junior person. So they take it very serious, and you it's serious stuff, but they'll learn over time to buffer that and to understand like what's natural, what's normal. I think that's the trick we've all learned. I think we all started like super hyped and freaked out when stuff went wrong, but I have confidence that like this one example, I think he's going to be fine over time as he gets more. You know, experience with like, okay, it's not the end of the world. We can recover. Yeah, that guy. You know, yeah, that developer just did the stupidest thing you could imagine at the worst possible time. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a good outlet is the down karma. I'm like, hey, dude, just down karma. You know, go click the button, give him this, write it up, let the hate flow through you, and not through my monitors, you know, it'll go out, and it'll be in the process, and we have a process for dealing with the fact that somebody screwed you at the 11th hour on the way out for a thing you've been working at straight for 3 days for a 1.0 launch of a major product, right? So as long as you have an outlet to kind of, so they feel like they just have to absorb it, and then nothing happens. That's the most. That's when monitors break.
Yeah.
But if you could, like, take the kryptonite, you know, hit, and then, like, redirect it out to some place where something will happen, I think he'll do better.
Thank you.
Hi, I think I'm starting, you know, I was junior a few years ago. I've been doing this job for a while, learning to be a manager, learning to become more calm like the all of you up there. So I really enjoy these stories, and I think, you know, it helps to sort of think, like John says, you know, hope is a perpetual sort of force for good.
Yeah.
But one question I have is, I feel like compared to the systems of yesterday, I get this sense that release engineers, more of us come with a background in software engineering and computer science, and we like to write code. Mm-hmm. And one question I always feel is like, sometimes I always feel like if I only work a little harder and I automate a little better and my systems come out a little better, I don't need to hire, right? These things are easy. We know, you know, what it's about. Why, like Sarah was saying, work seems to keep on coming. Mm-hmm. But if it's all, you know, we need to monitor, we need to log, we need to run lint tools, we need to automate, right? It seems like it should be easy. It should be, you know, we should keep it under control, but when do I hire? What is the limitations of coding? When does it take to hire, and how do you grow this organization? I find that conflict really difficult.
I want to start this one, if I may. First of all, best of luck as a manager. As I told several people who were first-time managers reporting to me, it's a super great, scary thing to be doing because you're actually holding several other people's careers and lives in your hands. So treat that with dignity and respect. Yeah. So just and good luck with it. In terms of when to hire and what can you just automate with the team you have, et cetera, I think I'm a total, as you noticed earlier today, I'm a total fanatic on baby steps. I will not even attempt to automate something or even have someone start to automate something unless you can do it by hand 3 times in a row. Because I feel there's too many times people deep dive into automating something, having some rough idea of what they're trying to do, and then they're debugging their automation at the same time as trying to debug the process. So I want a wiki page or an email or something that says, do this, then do this, then do this, then do this. And I want to be able to hand that to somebody else and say, do it and see if it works. I'll watch them and I'll say, no, don't press return if it's the wrong thing. But, you know, debug that. And that's your written spec for starting automating. So that's one thing. And I would automate as a little bit and make it better, and a little bit and make it better. The other thing I would keep in mind is that interviewing and hiring is time consuming. You want to interview carefully, because your best case scenario, you're going to convince someone to quit their job and come put their career in your hands. And you want to treat them right. Worst case scenario, you hire someone because you weren't paying attention. They come in, and then it turns out they're totally a bad fit. Now you've got to deal with a management problem, which is going to take a bunch of your time. And you've also messed up. They had a job before they came to you. Like, if you end up having to fire someone who you just hired because you didn't, now they're out of a job and they had a job, and you're still down a person, and you've dealt with a whole bunch of legal stuff. This is an overall fail. So and also, when you have hired a new person, even if they're the greatest person in the world, they need onboarding. You need to show them around. That means I describe it, you're net minus a half person for some number of weeks or months, depending on the person you've hired. So hiring is something you do very, very carefully. And if that means you just have to suck it up a bit longer until you find the right person, I hold the line until I find the right person. I've done this where I've had open recs and people are like, just hire someone. I'm like, mm-mm. I would rather leave a rec open instead of hiring in someone who may or may not be a good fit and then have to fire them if they're not a good fit. And by the way, waste a bunch of time onboarding, and it's disruptive to the rest of the team, and there's moral questions, so.
But that sounds horrible, right? Like, it's don't automate too much because you need to figure out the time to do it. But don't hire too many people because you need to trust these people, but it's hard to trust them. So how do you not end up being all of us being like Chuck, right? Like, how do you not how do you not end up being the one where like, yeah, we have this process. It really sucks, but I know how to do it by hand, and I got my 3-page thing to do it, and I do it by hand. And man, I just need the time to automate it or spend some time. But, well, I don't have time to hire. I don't have time for this, right? Like,
yeah, but
it seems like there was this whole talk about being the asshole of holding the line or all this sort of stress, right? To be very zen, but at the same time find a way. I started going boxing, right? My boss is like, why are you doing this?
It's better in the gym than in the office. Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But I feel like, how do you grapple with that? It seems like there is no good solution.
Yeah, so what I said there was actually slightly different to your summary. So I do want you to automate things, right? I mean, that's what it's, automation is where you want to be. But I don't think if you can take your state of the world now and your nirvana situation, I don't think you can go from here to there in one jump, realistically. You'll never have the time, and you won't know if you actually hit the right target till you get there, right? But I think you can make small incremental changes and be prudent about it. And the reason I mentioned the thing about do something manually 3 times before you start automating, I've seen many people start into I'm just going to automate this. And they go off into a 3-week running around in the weeds project before they realize they actually don't know what they want to do. And if they just sat down for an afternoon and said, okay, can I do it by hand? Actually, I can't, because it sort of works here, but it doesn't cover this case and it doesn't cover that case. And then they should go back and rethink the entire automation. So don't waste any of your possible time on dead ends or false starts. Try and do it by hand a few times first. That's what I was trying to say, though.
So I think this might have been a point you made at the start of your talk yesterday morning, the idea of, it was someone anyway, first do no harm. I think that's
was that Chuck?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry, Chuck.
It's okay.
but it can be so tempting to say, I'm just going to put this together, you know, or and you know, it's not a big thing, it won't break anything else, et cetera. Or it's so tempting to say, look, I know I need someone who does scripting. I can clearly see this candidate can do scripting. I don't really know how they're going to work as far as understanding the environment that we're in and all that, but I know they can do scripting, and we've got plenty of people on the team with social skills, and I'm sure we can make it work with this one person. Yeah, it's very tempting, and sometimes you are under a lot of pressure to get that release out the door or fix that process or add automation for that process. Believe me, I know. But it really can take so much more time if you start down the wrong path. It's a balancing act because you can't, you know, unless you've worked with someone, you don't really know, even with a lot of interviews, how it's going to be like to work with them. You do have to take chances. You can't be in paralysis waiting for 100% sure that this is the right thing to do. Not everyone on my team does everything exactly the way I would do it, but there you have to allow for some individual variation and let people make mistakes if you have management support to let them make mistakes. That's it. You know, I mean, if I'm held responsible if someone on my team makes a mistake, I mean, yes, I am responsible, but if I'm worried that my manager is going to say to me, you should never have let that person try it on their own without working with them through it 15 times to make sure they had it, you know, if you don't have management support to do some experiments or to try a few things, or if you don't have a good mechanism to feel like, you know, with throttling pushes to production or however you're doing it to reduce some of that risk, it's very hard to take chances in either hiring or automation. You don't want a script that you write that's supposed to make everything easier suddenly pancake half your production servers. You know, and I've been on a team where that happened, and then suddenly everyone was terrified of automating anything. You know, I'll stop now.
Yeah, I'll give you
So I think part of it is also just being able to have the guts and the foresight to hit the pause button sometimes when you're stuck in a loop where you're constantly doing manual deployments, mm-hmm. and you know you have all these requirements coming at you and say, hold on, we're going to have to let some things drop in order for the net gain of automating this process that we're constantly doing that's, you know, very troublesome when you're clicking the wrong buttons. So you have to kind of, you know, sometimes just look and just let certain things drop.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing was we had, like when I did that one thing about one day, the day after a release was off limits, we weren't going to be fixing major pieces of infrastructure, right? This was just the checking for disk space and like defragging disks. I mean, like just basic trying to like clean things up. But it paid off. Like, it went from like we could work for an hour or two before interrupts to we had a day before interrupts to after a while we started having predictably a day or two a week without interrupts. And then you started to build up and then you started to be able to work on bigger projects and people didn't care that you were working on other stuff because the things that their pain threshold, you'd kind of reduce down a bunch of the problems. I wasn't as much before. I used to think it was like iterative development and would slow things down, but I'm based on my last couple of jobs, I would be a 100% religious convert on this thing of like, fix something small today. Don't ever stop fixing something. Like just every postmortem you do, you come out of it with, what are we going to fix in the next 24 hours so that one thing gets slightly better? It may not even be the right fix long-term, but I think that's a mindset if I could indoctrinate, I would.
Just two quick things to that. One, as far as getting resources, hiring is going to be slow, and then, like you say, 6 months to get them going, generally. Don't be afraid to pull in people from the engineering organization. So all the tools I got in the beginning at Facebook was because I went to an engineer and said, I need this. Can you write this so I can do the cherry picks with this, you know, you know, give me a PHP front end to this thing, mm-hmm. or solve some problem. And generally, you'll find people who are, you know, frustrated or closeted release engineers who will help you or have a passion for this stuff or, you know, like doing this stuff. And you can find them in the dev organization. So lean on those people to do stuff for you. Mm-hmm. The other thing is we're going to automate a lot. And your kind of question was a little bit towards, like, are we going to just automate things so we're almost out of a job or so we don't even have to be in the loop? And that's fine, but I'm an advocate of having this subjective analysis in the process. And no matter how close we get with continuous deployment or how fast we get or how smooth it is, I still want that human interaction or the experience of the subjective analysis to say, like, this is not smart, or this is risky, or this might be a problem. So that, I think, is going to keep us all employed forever, hopefully, because we have that experience and can make those subjective calls no matter what the machine says in the end.
Just one more add on that. I think the more that you can help your team with communication, expectation setting, transparency, the more likely you're going to be able to say, I'm hitting the pause button. I mean, hopefully, you're not just going to say it and hit it. if you have a chance to actually say, look, in a week or in a month, whatever the time frame is, we're going to have to stop adding, we'll be queuing stuff up for further automation work. But right now, in July, we're going to have to be focusing mainly on whatever it is. If you can set the expectation, the most problems we've had in different teams that I've been on is if we weren't doing a good enough job of setting expectations of, you know, these are our priorities. We do want to help you. We will get to you, but these are our priorities for this month. You know, people are more likely to be able to deal with that gracefully than just, you know, an unanswered email or whatever. So
this is more of a nuts and boltsy kind of question, but I'll ask it. Databases. What would be your preferred method of handling databases in a release process? All of them.
So, you mean you're concerned about, like, schema updates?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
Schema
like,
data to a certain extent, but generally schema.
Where you can only roll forward and it's hard to go back, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there are tricks you can do. I mean, I'm no expert in this. I'm usually on this, the receiving side of what happens after the fact. but there are tricks and methods you can use to make things kind of forward and backward compatible. The way you lay out, you know, you can take advantage of some idiosyncrasies with MySQL and Facebook's case, where you can kind of roll out the new schema without breaking, you know, things of the old. In general, you know, just to kind of solve this problem, and this goes back to what Daniel was saying in Netflix, is that if I can hide things behind gatekeepers or feature flags, so I can stage my back end, bring up my new interfaces or my new schema and stage that, and then have all the production code go out, and then have some reasonable amount of time where I'm sure, like, okay, enough of the machines or have the new production code. And then this is probably the scariest thing we do, is you can flip that gatekeeper, that feature flag at one moment. Okay, back end looks good. Those machines are up waiting for traffic. The front end production code's been pushed. It's just waiting to be turned on. And I hate doing this, but sometimes you have to throw the switch. Like a big blade switch goes up on both sides, and stuff connects, and sparks fly, and hopefully there's no smoke. So that's kind of the worst-case scenario, but that does solve the problem. I don't know if anyone has a more elegant solution or not.
We're about to lose one of our panelists who realized that 1800 is not 8 p.m. So thanks to John for the talk this morning and sitting on the panel this afternoon.
Yeah, sorry for the emergency run out. I booked, this is what you get when you book a flight late at night.
Thanks, John.
Who would like to?
Yes, we need a volunteer to take John's place.
Sit up here. I saw you settling back. Now wait.
And I'll just follow up a little more on the database. Just a this is probably too low level detailed for you, but just to say that we use Liquibase for the automation of our database updates.
Works
all for you?
Yes, yes. Some of the developers who were used to with their, you know, hand-fed baby databases just being able to do things, it takes, you know, some communication to get them to do that, but we haven't noticed issues with Liquibase. Now, we're not doing things at the massive scale. I mean, we have big, crunchy, you know, databases, but it's not like we have millions of users hitting our genetics databases at once. So it's kind of a different issue.
Any other questions, comments?
Been rolling around in my head for a while, but and I've gotten this kind of feedback in the past. I've been doing release engineering for like 30 years, it feels like. Never my intention, but hey, what do? You do what you're good at. I have had some managers who have, you know, given me the comment of, well, you're lucky that there's one of you doing this job for, you know, these 200 developers. So it comes around to the question of what's a good ratio between, you know, how many release engineers to lines of code to branches of development to complexity of automation? Is there somebody started writing a formula so we can take it to these managers and say, you know, I'm really doing three jobs here? So that's my question.
The preferred ratio is no developers.
That's a good question. I generally haven't done it to developers, like, you know, the ratio of release engineers to developers. It generally goes down to products. So it has more to do with the complexity of the product, how many parts there are to it, how many shippable pieces there are to it, how fast does it go, what's the release schedule, things like that. So if I had to make metrics, and I'm sorry I don't have any to tell you, but those are the counters that I would put together. Because, you know, I'm thinking of just an experience. I was an early employee at VMware, right? So that was when VMware started, I set up a little release world, a release environment for VMware with CVS and then Subversion and then Perforce. It was one product. It was the VMware workstation. And then as it became, in those days it was GSX and ESX, the enterprise and the mid-range thing. And at that point, I needed more release engineers because, okay, now I can't do the enterprise product and the personal product and the mid-range product, so I need somebody to go deal with the enterprise stuff. And then I hired another release engineer to go look at that. So it was always more a complexity of the software we were shipping more than who was producing it. And I got this problem now that, you know, Facebook, we bought a company called Atlas, which is in Seattle. By the way, if you know any release engineers in Seattle who want to work for a great company, they can come talk to me. But I need two release engineers in Seattle because, okay, Atlas is one product. And I looked at it and like, oh, shoot, it's a ad serving kind of business that we bought from Microsoft or someplace. And it's got a front end, it's got a back end, it's got a billing server, it's got ad delivery, it's its own. I'm like, that's a whole company. I'm like, yeah, it was a whole company. And now it's part of your thing. So obviously I can't add that to my release engineers. I need to staff up because it is six different parts. So that's what I would look at. It's like how many functional deliverables are you fighting with?
I'm going to add, since we lost a panelist, I'm going to talk. So a lot of it depends on how automated you can make. There's three release engineers, full-time release engineers in our organization, and we support a couple of thousand different projects. And our goal is to make the developers self-service so that they can use the automated build tools to do the builds themselves. We add the value in helping them set up their builds following best practices. We've written an audit tool that will go through their projects to check to see if they're following our best practices and make suggestions. And so, because actually doing the releases isn't a lot of fun. No one wants to just actually do the releases. So we want it to be automated as possible so that we have the humans involved where they're needed to make decision points about test results, make decisions about how do we set things up, make decisions about deployment. And so we try to leverage that as much as possible. And a lot of what we do is consulting and consulting with the teams. So I don't know if that helps.
I guess similar to what they were talking about, but I just remember leaving one job where I was one developer, I was one config management person on a team of five or six config management people, and my baby was a project of 150 developers on a fairly stable, you know, code base. So I was busy, but not frantic supporting all of them, and I went from there to a job where they'd never had a CM. They had some people who kind of knew sort of things that ought to be done, you know, but and that was me leaving that team of 150 people to a 12-person, 15-person web app team that had no, you know, they were using a version control system, you know, but, you know, going from, you know, the first month I was there, they had a release weekend, you know, which was rather grueling. I remember laying down on a couch for like a half-hour nap sometime over the weekend. You know, going from that kind of thing, and they just didn't know things like you edit the configuration files you're going to put into place before the night of the deploy. You know, you have these things staged so you can just swap them in. You put things in and out of the pool. You know, so there was a lot of knowledge they just didn't have and a lot of automation that they needed. So, you know, I was more busy at that job than I had been with the 150. So it's hard to quantify without listing out a bunch of different variables, and then it's a complex analysis problem.
I had good luck with a software engineering question before, so I'm going to go for another one. So I really like the idea of date-based releases, but one of the problems that I've kind of run into thinking this through in my head is sometimes the marketing department has a very specific idea of what features are going to go into a release, or you have some new product that you're going to launch, and the whole company is sort of you know, bannering behind this whole new set of features on this date that maybe it's a brand new product. So how do you sort of combine some of these best practices with having the releases continue even if a certain feature is not ready, with the rest of marketing and product management saying, no, these two things are glued together and they're going to be released on this date and we might already have some press about it? I know that's like why software is hard, but...
So... You're right. I mean, the realities of shipping software are such that you will get in these situations. And again, we're just not a draconian rule here. If there becomes the way, I will, you know, we allow a certain number of those clown shows every now and then. I mean, the big clown shows are 1.0 releases, which are a shit show from right to the very last second. I mean, we're literally taking changes the hour of the release to rebuild it and do it. So you have to make, you have to just accept those. What I won't accept, I just don't want to be in the situation because of incompetence or inattention, right? It's like, we have a way to do things. If you just are that much plugged in, went to the onboarding or you know, have been here at the company long enough to understand how things are, been paying attention at all, we can pretty much solve this problem without having you come down and shove this thing down my throat, tell me it has to go out on Tuesday, otherwise the world ends. It's like, and I look back like, well, you know the frickin' Super Bowl was on this day. Why are you telling me the day before the Super Bowl that you want this thing pushed, right? Not saying that was a real-world example, but it might have been. So that's the part that drives me nuts, and that's what I'm going to really rail against and say, like, this person, you know, this group or somebody needs to be, I'll say punished, but attention needs to be given here so they don't pull this crap again. So use your judgment. I want to do it. Now, you don't want to get in the situation where that is the every time. Like, okay, we have to have this feature in and you're delaying. And so that's the only thing to watch for. Just do it when you need to do it. If you see the trend is going that way, every time that marketing or PMs or whatever is just driving things, stop and reassess how you're doing things and why you're doing the things the way you are. Because you cannot, you will be miserable with feature-based releases for more than two or three cycles in a row. And everyone's going to be miserable. And in, you know, you guys are based in Silicon Valley, right?
We're a distributed company.
Distributed company. Well, yeah. In Silicon Valley, all the companies I've worked have been in, you know, and been in in Silicon Valley. It's an engineering, all you know, the best companies I've been at were engineering-centric companies. They were founded on by engineers for because they had cool technology or whatever. And we're, you know, in that case, it's rare that PMs and marketing decide things like that, because engineering has enough clout to say, call bullshit and say, yeah, we're not going to make a fool of ourselves or rush this out because of some marketing requirement. So we have a little bit more punch to kind of keep those things in check. But having said all this, yes, you're going to come into times when you need to cram in features and do it. We do it. We stay up all night. We get it done. But I'm not going to do that more than a few times, definitely not a couple times in a row. Are we on time, Dinah?
I'd also like to add that automation and getting fast feedback does help mitigate some of that risk. So if your build takes 2 days to do and, after 2 days, that's when you know your feature's broken, there's something you can do to address that, at least, you know, speed up that process.
Any other questions, comments? Well, I want to thank you all very much for being a part of the very first ever USENIX Release Engineering Summit. And put November 10th on your calendar. The call for participation will go out real soon now. Like I said, I'm looking for to fill out the program committee. I've got a couple more positions on it I'd like to fill out. So contact me, mcnutt@google.com, if you're interested in being involved in any way or have any questions. And I hope to see you all in Seattle in November. There's going to be talks at LISA that are pertinent to release engineers. So it's going to be a full week of tutorials and technical sessions and birds of a feather sessions and the hallway track. So it's going to be great. So I hope to see you all there. And don't forget to fill out your evaluation form.